After years on the road, Timmy parked the van and picked up the mic to bring you this podcast that features interviews with people from hardcore to hair metal. This is Talk To Me with your host, Joshua Toomey.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Talk To Me. This is episode 84, and on this episode, I speak to Gene Hoagland. Yes, the Atomic Clock himself joins the Talk To Me podcast to talk about his new DVD, The Atomic Clock Strikes 2. But we also talk about Testament, we talk about DeLoreans, we talk about Slayer, we talk about Death, we talk about Death Clock, and so much more. Another great hour-long conversation, just like last week with Mina Caputo. And I just want to say thank you to everyone out there. That was definitely the most downloaded episode that was not picked up by Blabbermouth or the metal blogs. That was through the power of word of mouth and every one of you sharing it to your friends, letting your friends know if they're Life of Agony fans, hey, check out the Talk To Me podcast. Mina Caputo was just on. I know I picked up a ton of new listeners last week. That was so much feedback last week. So just thank you to everyone out there that shares, retweets, does everything you can to let your friends know that you're listening to the Talk To Me podcast, and I have some great guests, and I continue to have great guests. 2017 is looking so good. Like, I just got another confirmation for a guest coming up. You guys aren't going to believe the caliber of guests that are coming on this show. So I just want to say thank you to each and every one of you out there that listens each and every week. And with that, let's get to a nice iTunes review, because guess what? We have an iTunes review this week. If you're out there listening, make sure you're going over to your iTunes, you're rating, you're reviewing, and you know, that just helps out. I know every podcast out there says it, rate and review, but it helps. And this one comes from the UK, and not the University of Kentucky, but the United Kingdom. Adam 41, 5 stars. Deep Cut Delight is the title of this one. Love the podcast. It is fun, but thoughtful. The interviews are very well balanced, and it is great entertainment. What is exceptional is that Josh allows his guests to talk without the need to feed an ego or follow an agenda. Here's to many more. Well, thank you, Adam 41. Thank you for listening over there in Europe, in the UK, wherever you are abroad. I see the numbers. I see, you know, the countries that you guys are listening in, and it's absolutely amazing. You know, I got my fans in Australia, got the fans overseas, and obviously here in the beautiful United States of America, you guys are here too. So thank you guys to everyone out there. Also Canada, huge numbers in Canada. I don't know what's going on up there, but you guys are amazing too. So thank you to each and every one of you out there for checking out the Talk To Me podcast each and every week. I want to mix it up a little bit for the Talk To Me cover of the week. I love the band A Day to Remember. A few years ago, they did a great cover of the Kelly Clarkson song, Since You've Been Gone. I just want to go and listen to some A Day to Remember on this episode. And the Talk To Me cover of the week brought to you by puckhockey.com. That's P-U-C-K-H-C-K-Y. Guys, make sure to head over to puckhockey.com. They've got Head PE stuff, Doyle stuff, Tom Hazard, David Ellefson, 36 Crazy Fist. You can get some hockey tees over there too, hockey players. Your favorite skaters are probably over there too. So make sure, puckhockey.com, P-U-C-K-H-C-K-Y. Shop till you drop. And when you check out, use the promo code TALK, T-A-L-K, as in Talk To Me, for 10% off your entire order. Yes, TALK, T-A-L-K, for 10% off your entire order. So let's check out A Day to Remember with Since You've Been Gone.
Since you've been Chris Kale from Five Finger Death Punch. You're listening to Talk To Me. Just like Jekyll and
Hyde. All this anger inside. And that was Since You've Been Gone, A Day to Remember, covering a great Kelly Clarkson song. A lot of fun here on the Talk To Me podcast. And speaking of fun, the guest this week, Gene Hoagland, man, we had a blast talking. Talked for over an hour with Gene. So many great topics. Like I said earlier, you know, Slayer, Testament. We talk about death. We talk about Death Clock. We talk about what is it like to play to a cartoon. I mean, could you imagine trying to play along to a cartoon? I understand it's a click track, but still, that seems like a lot of pressure. I don't like that kind of pressure. No me gusta. But yeah, Gene Hoagland, super fun guy. And once again, just honored to have him on the podcast. And without any more of my ramblings, let's talk to Gene Hoagland.
By the power of Grayskull.
You are listening to Talk To Me.
Hey, Gene, Josh Toomey with the Talk To Me podcast.
Hey, Josh, how's it going there?
Not too bad. How are you?
I am excellent.
Fantastic. All right, man, well, let's get into this. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Sounds good, absolutely.
You know what's funny is there have been now three guests on the podcast that going into it, I was like, wow, these are some scary dudes. And one being Glenn Benton of Deicide, two being Chris Beattie from Hatebreed, and now you... Which is funny because all three of those guys ended up being like, you know, somewhat cuddly teddy bears type things. And, you know, Glenn Benton, obviously, you know, upside down cross burnt in his forehead and he ended up being a jokester.
Oh, yeah.
And then Chris Beattie, every photo I've ever seen of him, he's making a scour. And I went down and interviewed him and, you know, great dude. And then with you, you know, every time I see photos and stuff, you know, you got sunglasses on and your hair is down and, you know, you played in Death and Testament and all these crazy bands. And then I started watching videos the other day of you and you're like, hey, it's Gene Hoagland. You know, I like to have fun. And I'm like, wow, I'm totally representation, man.
I'm the cuddliest teddy bear of all three of us, I tell you.
well, probably, you know, I don't know if Glenn Benton's a big cuddly teddy bear or not.
Hey, I remember a few years ago when Strapping Young Lad and Deicide, we both played the Milwaukee Metal Fest, and it was one of those kind of shared backstage rooms, you know, shared green room, dressing room for Deicide and Strapping. And Glenn comes in, and, you know, I've known Glenn forever, and we're saying hi, and then he kind of sits across from Devin, and Devin was telling me later, I kind of left the room then, and Devin was telling me later, he's like, all of a sudden, Glenn Benton's sitting right down in front of me. And I'm like, holy shit, that's Glenn Benton right there. Holy moly. And he's like, I didn't know, he wasn't real familiar with Deicide's music. You know, he's not really a super death metaler. But he's like, I didn't really know what to talk to him about. So I just asked him, how's your kids? You know, because I've heard he has kids. And so Glenn was like, you know, I got the 12-year-old who's just a total hell, just a hell raiser. And then I got the little tiny one. And I, you know, I'm busting out the sippy cup for it. For my little one. And Devin was really proud at the fact he got Glenn Benton say the word sippy cup.
That's amazing. Yeah, he when he was on the podcast, he had told a story about having to go and pick up his son from school because his son had, I guess, taken his iPod out in class and had it, you know, confiscated by the teacher, and Glenn had to be the one to go pick it up. And I'm like, you know, what happens when Glenn Benton shows up at your high school to, you know, if you're the teacher, what do? You know, you're like, you just give the iPod back. You have to.
Oh my God! Yeah, hell's a coming.
No pun intended on that one. But I wanted to get into one other thing before we delve too much into the Atomic Clock Strikes 2. I started watching it last night, and first things first, man, is that your DeLorean?
Oh no, God, that was really hilarious. No, that was just the director. Said, hey man, there's a DeLorean parked outside the you know, the studio, and you know, I got this idea for a shot, and I've already talked to the guy who owns the DeLorean, and you know, do you mind doing this shot? And I'm like, that's fine. And I remember at the time we filmed it, I think that was like the 25th anniversary or the 30th anniversary or something of whatever movie that DeLorean comes from, the Back to the Future
thing. Back to the Future, yeah.
And Yeah. And so he's like, yeah, all we got to do is just, you know, we'll just push you stopping. And then I was like, hey, well, how about if we have my boot coming out, you know, just
right.
like get a, I augmented it with a shot of the boot coming down. Like I was kind of, do you remember that, that old animation called Bambi versus Godzilla?
No, I don't. I'll have to check that out.
It's about a 30, you probably found it on YouTube. It's about a 30-second clip. The little wood forest music is playing, and there's a little Bambi just eating. And then at the very end, all of a sudden, this giant Godzilla foot comes down and smashes Bambi. And so I had that in mind for, hey, let's do a shot like that. So, yeah, but that was totally, yeah, that's not my DeLorean.
Oh, man.
So, nor would I own a DeLorean, but...
Well, what was funny about that is, you know, I grew up playing music and I did some touring, things like that. And I always said, like, if I ever, you know, got the big record deal or something, like the first splurge I ever would ever do would be buy a DeLorean. So when I saw you pull up in that in your video, I was like, man, if he has a DeLorean, he's like the coolest dude ever.
Oh, that's fun. Nah, well, shit. Nah, at the time, I was driving a 1997 Honda.
That's great.
But I got to admit, it was the pimpiest Honda ever. Like, the person I bought it from was, you know, it only had like 8,000 miles on it, and it was like 10 years old when I got it. And geez, it just didn't look like any other Honda I'd ever seen. It was like tricked out and lowered and scooped and all this crazy pimpy stuff they did to it. So that was pretty fun driving. You know, people like, hey, that's a really cool car. What is it? It's a Honda Accord. I'm like, holy shit. So
that's great. Yeah, the you can get DeLoreans now with it at somewhere in Houston. They actually remanufacture, like they have a warehouse of all old parts, and they manufacture DeLoreans now. So you can actually go buy like a quote unquote brand new DeLorean. And something popped up on my Facebook timeline is today would have been John DeLorean's birthday, which I thought was really odd. Like after I watched your video, and then it popped up on Facebook today, I was just like, wow, that's kind of crazy. It all coming together like that.
Holy. Well, that's some synchronicity out there in the old universe there, I guess.
So I grew up a bass player, so you know, I have a appreciation for drummers.
How long did it take you to grow him up? How long did it take you to grow him up?
Well, I actually have a bass player farm in the back, but you know, with Pro Tools and Pro Tools and technology, they're kind of getting weeded out, you know, no pun intended.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you.
But you know, just growing up, obviously being quote unquote in the rhythm section, you know, my, obviously watching your videos last night, I didn't really, it's not like I'm going to sit down behind a kit now and be like, okay, well, I'm going to do a paradiddle with my left foot while I'm doing a run with my right foot. And, you know, but it's just fun to watch. And I think, coming away from watching the video, I mean, even if you're not a drummer, but you're a fan of the bands that you played in, I think that it's a very cool experience to kind of watch you just solo over, you know, over the Testament songs and the Death songs and the Strapping Young Lad songs and stuff. I think it's a cool experience, even if you're not a drummer.
Well, very cool. Thank you very much. And that is definitely one thing that I tried to incorporate in the planning of all my DVDs is like, let's make this not only for drummers and you know, not even necessarily for musicians. But if somebody wants to, you know, take a couple hours and check this out, hopefully there's enough stuff there for the non-musician or the non-drummer that they're coming away from it going, hey man, that was cool. That was a cool couple of hours. You know, I'm cool with that. So excellent.
So I'm going to ask you the question. I know you probably ask it 1,000 times, but I wanted to ask it personally because I could have researched this and got the answer, but I mean, what's with the ankle weights and the combat boots?
Well, starting with the boots, that's merely, like, I have since retired these boots. I had those boots for, like, a dozen years or something, and you could see them really falling apart, you know, like, as I'm playing. I think, you know, giant holes in them and stuff. The boots were merely, that's just what I wore, you know. I wore those boots all day long, and I've never been a guy that's like, well, I have to change into my drumming shoes now, you know, like these days, you know, my lady bought me an amazing pair of boots, but I can play in them, but they're kind of like, they kind of, you have to lace them up. And those boots that I wore for dozens of years, I just stretched them out so much that they were just kind of slip on and slip off. And especially when I'm on tour, I take my boots off. I take my shoes off a lot, you know, if I'm climbing into my bunk or whatever. So those were just a simple footwear. And, you know, I still, like nowadays, I'm just playing in tennis shoes. I did 20 years of playing in boots, and it took a little while to you know, acclimatize myself back to a tennis shoe. But these days, like the guys from Testament, they have shoes that they, you know, they have their stage shoes just so I guess they don't sweat up their regular shoes. I get that. But me, I take one pair of hoofs with me, and that's it. So, but the ankle weights came in 1988. We were, I was in Dark Angel. We were about a week away from recording my personal second album, an album called Leave Scars. And I remember about a week before, I just lost my feet. I just lost my legs. You know, I'm trying to play stuff, and it's all of a sudden it's coming really, really hard for me. And at the time, I was just trying to figure out a way, like, how can I make this easier on myself, play these speeds easier? It kind of turned out later that I think we were just rehearsing at an absolute breakneck pace, but I went out and I just put a little bit of my athletic experience together. And I remembered my baseball playing days when I was younger. And, you know, as you are in the on deck circle, meaning you are the next guy to go to bat, the guy up at the plate is, you know, taking hacks. You're warming up, and usually you throw onto your bat a little metal batter's a donut. You know, they're just called a donut. It's just a round ring, and that adds a pound, or you throw a couple of them on there, adds a couple of pounds to your bat, and then you pop them off, and your bat is super light, and you could swing it a lot faster. And so I just kind of applied that same sort of notion to, well, let me try some ankle weights, and let me try it out. And sure enough, they worked instantly. You know, I didn't know what I was doing yet, but I just warmed up. I think maybe we played a song or two with the ankle weights on, and then we were getting into the super tough double bassy songs and we were just rehearsing the album material at the time, and then everything came super easy. So I thought, well, hey, you're really onto something with these ankle weights. And then we started playing shows, and I think it was just comfortable to wear them for the first couple of songs, then take them off when we start getting into the super hauling stuff, and everything just became so easy. So I've always said, you know, you have these ankle weights on, they're adding extra weight and extra pressure to your warm-ups or your first couple of songs, and when you do pop them off, your feet just fly. So that was really the whole concept to them. And if I'm playing an unchallenging double bass song, then I'll play stuff with the ankle weights. I know there's going to be a hauling double bass song coming up somewhere in a Gene Hoagland set. You know, like, all the bands I ever play in, they like to torment me that way. So, you know, I'll play the majority of the set with them on a lot of the times, and then I'll pop them off before the super cooking song. I tracked a couple of the songs, a few of the songs, I think, on the latest Atomic Clock thing. I tracked those with ankle weights on. And that's just to show people the practical application of them. And a lot of times people just come to me and go, man, you do all this crazy stuff and you got leg weights on. You're a dick. You know, like, F you, buddy.
Right.
So that's a fun reaction to me. So.
And you also play like an open style. Are you naturally left-handed, or you just play that way? Or you play open? Go ahead.
No, really, the reason I play open-handed is the only reason why is, you know, I mean, I am ambidextrous, and I think everybody is ambidextrous to a large degree. You know, I do a lot of stuff left-handed. I do a lot of stuff right-handed, a lot of stuff left-footed, a lot of stuff right-footed. But really, I've said this many times, is the only reason I play open-handed is I used to air drum on my bed when I was a kid. And say you divide your bed into, like, say, four quadrants, the top two quadrants, number one is on your left side, number two is on your right side. I was on my number two top quadrant there where I would play because my record player was on that side of my bed. So I would sit on my bed, turn to the left, and play drums that way. And I noticed when you're pounding on your bed, if you're in the center top part of your bed, that's kind of low. And then, you know, it kind of goes, you know, and then the top right corner of your bed, you're, you know, it sounds higher. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess I want to have kind of a kick drummy sort of sound to what I'm playing. So I guess my left hand will be the kick drum, essentially, and the ride and the hi-hat and all that sort of stuff. And my right hand will be my snare pounding on the top corner of my bed. And had my record player been on the other side of my bed, I would have been a right-handed player, you know, I'm sure. So that's really about it. It's just, you know, record player placement at age 9.
Wow. That's so funny how your entire life can be manipulated by something that happens at such a young age like that.
Oh, man, it's crazy how much you get affected by your initial forays into things, you know. And if it works, it's like, okay, it, you know, if it ain't broke, don't break it. I'll just carry on like this. And I do remember, like, I was trying to enlist in the school band, and that wasn't going to happen. And everybody I would play with, or, you know, people that would, you know, older folks that would see the way I'd play, they'd be like, hey, you can't do that. You can't play open hand. You have to play right handed. And I was like, wait a minute. You know, even at a super young age, I'm like, wait, this is an expression that I'm doing. This is a musical expression. Who are you to tell me what I can and can't do? This works for me. I'm happy doing it this way. Why do you need to judge me? And it wasn't until I was a few years older and I brought a friend over who was an idol of mine. His name was Brian O'Brien from a band in LA called A La Carte. And this band used to headline over Van Halen in the clubs. And this is a band that, you know, listening to early Van Halen, they took a lot from this band A La Carte. And it's pretty well documented out there on some of these, like, kind of underground LA metal movies that are out there explaining A La Carte's story. But he was an amazing drummer, and he agreed to come over to my house and show me a couple of things. And, you know, he was the first guy that he saw my setup, and he's like, I love this. This is great. You can have a mountain of cymbals over here, a mountain of drums over here. This is awesome. You're onto something here, kid. And that was all I, you know, I already knew it. I already felt it, but he was the first person that gave me any kind of support in, you know, he was the first guy that didn't tell me I was wrong. So that, you know, at a young age, I got super affected by, you know, a little bit of positive reinforcement. So that was really helpful for me.
So you've played in pretty much every heavy band ever at this point. how often does your phone go off, your email go off? I mean, how, like, if someone sees that Testament has a week off, or they go like, oh shit, we need to get Gene in the studio, or just how full is your calendar, you know, up through probably 2018?
Well, yeah, it does get pretty full. And fortunately, since I have management, my personal phone never rings. I do not get texts. I don't get calls from friends going, hey, Gene, what's going on, man? How you doing? Nobody calls me. I don't get texts from anybody. Hey, I just got a week off. What are you up to, bud? You know, I don't get any of that. And I'm cool with that because I got a pretty hectic schedule even when I'm not on the road. So, you know, I can always be busy, and I am fortunate that my schedule is designated by me, you know, and that's pretty cool. So if I see a month long window down the road, I usually can say, well, I, you know, it's my choice to fill that window, or I'm going to take a little bit of a break and concentrate on all the other stuff non tour related for being a musician. So it can. It's pretty much my schedule is designated by myself, and Testament likes to, you know, they like to tour, and that's cool. And But if there's open opportunities where Testament is saying, hey, well, hey, look, it looks like Alex can't make this month, so we're going to take this month off, then cool. Or I might have something booked where they say, you know, hey, Gene and Steve might be going out and doing some death stuff, but, you know, we've got a couple shows that we want to play, and they have a couple of guys that they'll reach out to and, you know, have a sit-in drummer for a show or two, and or a sit-in bassist, and they've done that recently. But we try to keep our schedules pretty open for Testament, you know.
When you and Steve are in a room together, do you guys ever just bust out death stuff like at Testament practice? Like, you know, just jam it out or anything like that?
Boy, we don't get to jam all that much, I got to tell you, man. The only time we ever really get to jam, like jam is, well, actually, God, there's so many other things that we would jam first, but, you know, like, Steve and I like to just bust off into some noodly noodles here and there, but, you know, I think it's happened, and somebody from Testament might have gone, hey, man, what was that you guys were working on? It's like, ah, just death tune or whatever. And cool. But, there are so many things that we'll jam, you know, like we'll kick into some Rush or some Al Di Meola, and we even do that on stage with Death these days. Like when we're doing like a DTA touring kind of situation, we'll play 2 hours and we'll play 19 Death songs, but we'll still kick into, you know, a Rush tune, an Al Di Meola song, a Jimi Hendrix song, a just whatever. You know, we might hear a song that afternoon playing somewhere, and then we're jamming it that night. So that's fun.
What about when, just like in between like you and Alex, like I could just totally see like a crazy jam session going on between you guys.
That's, we've gotten into that too a few times, you know, and Alex has an amazing, catalog of songs. Like we can kick into some old Van Halen or some old Ozzy, or I got to admit, I am not the biggest jazz knowledge. I'm not the most knowledgeable person on a lot of the jazz that Alex is well versed in, but I know my fair share of, like, say, jazz fusion or some Al Di Meola. He knows a lot of that, or some Jeff Beck or something like that. We'll kick into that sort of thing. And every once in a while, Steve, Alex, and I, if Eric is, you know, just not come to the stage yet, a lot of times, you know, we'll bust into something really fun. And It's really neat when you're on stage during soundcheck and you're kicking it, you're copying a really good groove together or something, or something's coming together really cool with like just three guys. You notice the rest of the room kind of stops, you know, all the crew guys that are walking around, they just kind of stop in their tracks and like check it out for a minute. And then like the sound guy will come up later and go, hey man, that was really cool, you know, or whatever. So that's pretty fun.
So how are you taking all of the accolades that Brotherhood of the Snake has gotten? Like it ended up on so many top lists of 2016.
Oh, very nice. I got to admit, I don't really pay attention to much stuff like that. You know, it's a killer record. You know, we're really happy with it. So if other people are enjoying it, fantastic. How do I say this without sounding like a dick? I kind of expect that from Testament is you know, a pretty high-profile band, and this latest record is a really good, well-focused on being heavy metal record, so that's cool. I guess I haven't seen a lot of these end-of-the-year lists, but, I'm sure they're out there, and that's very cool, you know, and when it comes to accolades of any sort, I guess, like whether they're for the band or for something like just personal, where like myself as an individual is picked out, like, gee, you know, yay on your drumming. I try not to pay too much attention to that either, because I just figure for everybody that loves you, there got to be people out there that hate you too. So if you just don't pay too much attention to it, you don't have, you know, it just keeps you kind of grounded, I suppose. You don't hear the good stuff, and you don't hear the bad stuff either. So I don't read a lot of forums or anything like that. So, I mean, there could be a big contingent out there that hates my playing, but chances are I don't see it, you know?
There's definitely not that contingent out there. the one thing that I kept hearing was when Hardwired to Self-Destruct came out, the new Metallica record came out, a lot of people were like, oh, this is a great album. But then I also heard from multiple like sources, and it wasn't even like the same conglomerate of people, but a lot of people were like, yeah, but if you want a real thrash record, go get Brotherhood of the Snake. Like, I heard that multiple times, and I think that was a, you know, as great as the new Metallica is, like Testament, but not a great album.
Well, you know what? That is very cool. And yes, I agree 100% with that. And because it is a great thrash record. And I know, you know, I can only imagine that the world is excited at the fact Metallica has put out. I've heard a few tracks off the Metallica record, and it looks like they're focusing on trying to be a, you know, they're not, there are no Until It Sleeps on this record so far from what I've heard. It sounds like they're trying to be a focused, pretty, you know, like picking up the flag of heavy metal and waving it proudly. I back that. So if Metallica has put out a great killer metal album, then that only benefits us all, you know, like, if the Rolling Stones would come out with a fantastic record at this age, that would juice rock and roll, I'm sure. And so anything that Metallica can do for the rest of us. And yes, I agree. You know, Brotherhood of the Snake is a killer thrash record. If you're into thrash, this is a very well-focused, awesome, classic-sounding thrash album in a lot of ways. So that's pretty cool.
Very cool. I know you hung around like Dave Lombardo, Slayer, early 80s, 83-ish. What were your kind of, you know, early memories of Metallica? Do you remember them around 83, 84?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I saw their second show ever. And, boy, I tell you, I used to bump into those guys at the Woodstock all the time. And I caught a lot of their earlier shows. And I'm sure they would admit they weren't the band that they became even just a few months later, you know, because they started gigging in late March of 1982. And I think they had only been a band for about 6 months or so, 5 months, 6 months around that time. So it was a little rough. And, you know, you heard that version of Hit the Lights on the Metal Massacre, the very first Metal Massacre. And that was actually a decent representation of where they were at the time. You know, I don't even think James was playing guitar at that moment, you know? So, I just remember, you know, the other guitar guy was doing all the talking, you know, and that was Dave Mustaine.
Right.
I remember all of those days, and I predate that just by a couple of years. You know, I was 14 or 15, probably like 15 when Metallica was starting to put out, you know, starting to play. Slayer was out there doing their thing, and I had already been going to the clubs for a couple of years by then, and I was seeing all those bands that became the shitty ass radio cock rock millionaire metal bands. I saw all of them when they were in the clubs and actually pretty decent, you know, like a band like Rat was not really a radio sounding band. They just sounded heavy, and you know, Great White was a double bass accept loving metal band, you know, and God, I remember that. Yeah, they were cranking Fast as a Shark, you know, back in the day, going, fuck, the greatest thing ever. Yeah. And a lot of Great White songs when they were called Dante Fox were a bunch of double bass, you know, just classic metal sounding tunes. And I guess it was when Motley Crue, you know, and I'd seen all the Motley Crue shows, you know, ton of those, when I was 14 and all that stuff, 13, 14. And I was not impressed by Motley Crue just because, they sounded so different. You know, I was like, wow, this is like pop. And you know, I never liked when Judas Priest would put a pop song on. Like, I wasn't a big fan of like Living After Midnight or something. And Motley Crue like took that and like wimped it out even more. But hey, that got them on the radio. And then all these other like, you know, cool metal bands kind of followed suit and started looking silly, sounding silly. And that just was not my scene at all. So getting into the deeper underground European metal and you know, just other, you know, because North America didn't, or the U.S. at the time did not have a very vibrant metal scene. You had your Riot, Y&T, a few other bands, but, you know, so I would listen to Canadian bands and European bands, and then you'd have your Metallicas and your Slayers and all that sort of stuff coming out. And it's like, okay, well, now we're talking, you know, now at least bands are, I would prefer a band to sound more like Venom than Motley Crue or something right now. So, you know, Metallica kind of sounds like Venom, and so does Slayer quite a bit. So, so I do remember all those days very, very well.
Very, very cool.
And I'm sorry if I'm on a tangent there.
But, no. This is a you podcast. Know. You could talk for as long as you want.
Well, I was going to go into a little bit of Dave stuff for you.
Go
you
for
did
it.
Mention Dave. And, yeah. And like we had, it's, all this information is out there now anyway, you know, from Dave's mouth, you know, as well as mine. But, you know, I was around them really young. And I remember when Dave got his first double bass kit, I only, you know, he had been to my house. We had jammed a little bit, and all the Slayer guys had been to my house, and they watched us both jam one time. And I remember that he had gotten a double bass kit before Show No Mercy, but he recorded Show No Mercy single kick. And I was asking him about that, like, hey, dude, you got your double bass, but you're not, you know, where is it? And he was just like, man, I'm not coming along as quickly on the double bass as I was hoping. And I just figured, you know, for Show No Mercy, I'll just keep it single bass, cause that's what I'm familiar with. And, so we got together, you know, at Tom's house, and I sat behind his kit, and I just started showing him a few things, and I wasn't a double bass player, but I'd air drummed plenty of double bass in my life. And so I just started giving him some tips and tricks. Like, I remember he was having a left foot issue, and I was able to kind of talk him through that. And when they recorded the Haunting the Chapel EP, I was there, you know, I remember standing behind him, air drumming Capture a Sin, you know, and I remember I hit him in the back with a stick, you know, accidentally, and, you know, I got a pair of sticks, I'm just air drumming along right behind him. And God, who does that now? Like, you know, kid, get out of my space. You know, everybody was really young then, but I would be like, hey, there's some weirdo air drumming my song right behind me as I'm recording it. Take a hike, you know. Right. But he was super cool about it. And I remember, like, the bathroom was located directly right next to the drum kit. So, you know, I'd be sitting there while he's tracking Haunting the Chapel, which is a, you know, that's a motherfucker of a song to play in 1984. Nobody was playing double bass like that in 84, but he was, you know, he was doing it. And I just kept giving him, you know, just encouragement, like, yeah, you know, concentrate on your left foot. You're doing great. Sounds awesome. Left foot. And then it came time to record Chemical Warfare, they'd recorded Chemical Warfare probably second or something, or maybe first. And there was no drum carpet.
Oh, wow.
At the time. There was nothing to anchor the drums down. There was no carpeted floor at the studio. It was just a concrete floor. And when he started, you know, kicking into the tune, his drums were walking, they're called, you know, they're just moving away from you. And so, you know, he's like, hey man, can somebody come in here and, you know, hold my drum kit together? And I swear there was about, like, you know, six heads that just turned to me and said, well, you're the other drummer, you go do this. And so I remember, like, you know, I'm down there on my hands and knees, my arms are, you know, wrapped around mic cords, mic stands and cymbal stands. And, you know, I'm holding on to his kick drum. And I was just like, God, please get this done in like two takes or something, because I'm going to die otherwise, you know? And so every time I hear, you know, I remember he had some purple hydraulic, probably Evans heads on his kit. And he had a concert tom kit, meaning there are no bottom heads. And That's how I will always remember Chemical Warfare, because that opening, I'm looking right up into that drum, watching his stick hitting. And, you know, my head is essentially in the drum there. And that's when I was like, oh, God, please get this done in a couple of takes. That would be really cool if you do. So, and sure enough, he did. He killed it. And
yeah, somehow you're probably part of the drum sound of that.
Hoagland's hair right. Created that tom-tom. Totally.
That's great.
But, you know, there's some fun old memories and stuff like that. So that's really cool.
You're listening to Talk To Me.
after these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey, what's up, guys? Checking in here for a moment. If you want to support the Talk To Me podcast monetarily, make sure you're heading over to patreon.com/talktome, selecting a tier. So many great things over there. It's a couple of bucks a month, subscription type service, and it just allows me to continue to put money back into this podcast. And I would just appreciate it if you head over there. So yeah, patreon.com/talktome. I would much appreciate it. And if you want a Talk To Me t-shirt, make sure you're heading over to amazon.com, searching out the Talk To Me podcast. Get yourself a Talk To Me t-shirt. You can get the classic Talk To Me logo or the Backstage Pass logo. They come in men's sizes, women's sizes, and even kid sizes, so you can outfit the entire family in Talk To Me tees. Now back to my interview with Gene Hoagland.
This is Glenn Benton, Deicide, and you're listening to Talk To Me.
You've done you did the Death Clock tour and the Death Clock albums, things like that. How hard is it to play live to basically a cartoon? You know, I know you're playing to a click, but I mean, you know, that's got to be super stressful.
Well, it's not stressful. It is a lot of responsibility. You know, pretty much the entire show kind of rests on whoever is playing drums. The whole show kind of rests on your shoulders, and you cannot go off at all. And that's where I'm a pretty focused live drummer. I'm okay to play with the click and all that. And so me, I am just essentially playing to the click, and I have a bunch. You know, we have keyboards on tracks that, you know, we don't have a live keyboardist. So, you know, I'm playing to what I hear in my ears, which is essentially just Brendan's guitar and a little bit of his vocals, just to make sure everything's on track. But, you know, I never get to see what we look like. You know, I've been tempted to, you know, mount a little bicycle mirror on my kit just so I could look into it and see all the stuff going on behind me, you know. And there have been times when the click just is not there at the beginning of the set. You know, I know there's been a couple of times where we've worked with just like a fly-in date with just a local crew, a local sound man that some of our crew knows, and it's just easier to use the local guy. You know, sometimes they don't exactly know what's about to happen. They, you know, all of a sudden the set is starting, and there's no click, there's nothing, and it's going, you know, like, it's about to go. So, you know, I just got to kind of tap into some muscle memory, some clock memory sort of thing, and just play along as best as I can until, you know, halfway through the second song, all of a sudden the click comes on, and, you know, it turns out the sound man hit the mute button accidentally, and then he unmuted it. So, you know, stuff like that has happened, but, you know, you just, there's a lot of responsibility, but it's no big deal. It's really fun because I figure it's such a fun live show, you know, like, no matter what you might think about the cartoon or the actual TV show, the shows are incredible. Like, there have been so many people, like grizzled old people that are older than me, that are coming up saying, look, obviously I've been going to concerts for 30, 35 years, and this is the best concert I've ever been to. Not just gig, you know, not just, you know, gig in a nice theater, you know, I've seen everybody, and this is the best concert I have ever seen in my life. So it's like, wow, that's really cool. And that's one thing I've always loved, is being a part of any project that is a next level thing and touches people's lives, changes people's lives. You know, that's what I felt every night going on stage with Strapping, is that we are going to change people's lives tonight. And Death Clock is the exact same thing, you know, like Death Clock for a lot of the younger dudes out there. It's a gateway band to heavy music, you know. It's like they're just starting to get into, like, I don't know, Korn or you know, whatever radio band is out there, but they want to start listening to heavier stuff, and they like the TV show, so they go see the show when it comes through town. And it's absolutely a gateway to the heavy stuff for a lot of young dudes. So that's always pretty fun. You know, I like affecting people's lives in a super positive way and taking them off whatever path you're on, putting you on a new badass path. That's always fun. I always get into that. That's awesome.
Yeah, the Death Clock stuff is absolutely a gateway to for a lot of kids to get into metal, just because, you know, Adult Swim was, you know, such a huge presence, and you know, getting that on television at all has got to be crazy. So for kids to stumble upon that, you know, that's got to get them into the metal and everything.
I remember when I got the call from Brendan. I mean, it was, you know, said, "Hey, we're, you know, I'm Brendan Small. I have a TV show called Metalocalypse." And I'm like, "Okay, yeah, I just watched my first episode last night, and they only had two or three episodes on at the time." And I got to admit, the first episode I saw was everybody was in the submarine farting, and there was Murderface puking all over the place. And I'm like, okay, it's one of these kind of, you know, kind of Beavis and Butthead kind of, you know, I'm not sure if I quite understand the humor, but I understand where they're coming from. However, the music is badass. This is real. I would not expect this from a TV show in 2006 or whenever it premiered. And that was one thing. It's like, I might not have understood the humor right at first. I later got it, and I loved the show, but just on first impact, I was like, not too sure about this. However, the music is pretty deadly. So heck yeah, I want to do this record with you. And it just turned out really awesome. And all the records that we've done together ever since, I love working with Brendan. He's one of my favorite guys ever to work with, because he's just super cool. You know, I've never seen him break a sweat under any kind of pressure. And I've seen the pressure he's been under, and he is just super cool. He just takes it all in stride, and I've never seen him ever get down or stress on anything. He's, you know, he's pretty well put together, that's all. And so I really dig Brendan. I love the guy, and I'm always happy to work with him. And, you know, that's pretty cool.
That is very cool. Odd question for you. How about, what's like the strangest session you've ever done? Have you ever been called in for like a Britney Spears song or anything like that?
I have. Yes. I Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and Rihanna. I played on all their latest thrash metal albums. I'm kidding, of course, but... No, I have been called in to do some really non-metal-y stuff. And for instance, on the last DVD, my first one, just a plain old regular Atomic Clock, I did put a song from a couple of totally non-metal sessions. There was a guy named Mr. Plow that, you know, just a friend of mine in Canada, and he was able, you know, he worked Fishbone, so he had Norwood from Fishbone on bass, Rocky George from Suicidal on guitar, and Angelo Moore singing for him, and me on drums. That was super fun. That was an awesome album. And then there was a girl by the name of Jilly C from Chicago, and I had been pulled in to track her record, and she was just kind of like, you know, kind of riot girl, aggressive pop with really good songs. And I was happy to do it. And so I ended up putting one of the songs that I played with her on the last DVD, just to show that, you know, I am, you know, quite metal, but not merely. So there you go.
Very cool. I have a drummer friend that actually had a question for you. And, you know, obviously if you don't want to answer this, you don't have to, but, he was curious on how you get paid. Like, you know, is it a set Gene Hoagland rate? Is it, you know, for this band, I'll do it for this much? Is, you know, for this project, I need this much? I mean, like, what is the rate for Gene Hoagland, roughly?
There's a lot of zeros behind every one that's up there, I'll tell you that. But first of all, I have done this music for, you know, I've been touring now for, this is my 33rd year of touring, and I'm not even in my 50s yet. So,
this year you will be.
Yeah, that's right. Am I? Is it? Yeah, you're right. Jesus. So, you know, it's my love of playing music that comes first, and that's, you know, I'm always negotiable, but I don't really do anything for under like kind of 5 figures anymore, you know. So,
nice.
But it all depends on the project. It all depends on how much budget they have, and a lot of times I'll do a project where they're like, "Well, you know, we're pretty much you are our budget. You know, we're getting the studio for super cheap, and our engineer just he believes in us, so he's working for nothing, and you know, all our money is essentially going to you." And I'm like, "Thank you." You know, like, I ask for a lot, and most times I get it. And if you don't want to pay it, that's, you know, that's your choice. And I understand that. I get it. And sometimes people have to move on and find somebody else. And, but, you know, I do pretty well.
No, that's great. I mean,
yeah. And, you know, especially for being, when I started in this business, you know, when I helped start this business, you know, underground thrash metal, there was no money in this. There wasn't for years and years and years. And I always had a focus of building up my, I guess, my name through my playing. I just always tried to attack every album with a whole lot of, you know, just wow, you know, like a whole lot of personality. And so there just wasn't a lot of money going around for a lot of years, but that never deterred me. I made a lot of sacrifices early on in my life to, because this is what I wanted to do, you know, like I am definitely the poster child for living your dream. You know, when I was 11 through 13, that's when I was deciding this is what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to play in a rock band. There was no thrash metal at the time, but I loved heavy metal. So I'm going to play in some cool ass heavy metal band and I'm going to tour the world. And I never even thought about how much money there could have been or not. And especially when thrash metal broke out, it was like, wow, this is the ultimate style of metal. You know, like we're all creating the next badass metal that's going to be around forever. And regardless of what you want to say about thrash, thrash's influence is there today. Absolutely. Thrash influenced everything that came after it. Death metal, your aggro metal, your grindcore, your, you know, you name it, thrash metal was there being the dad of all of it. And our dad was Judas Priest and Iron Maiden and that sort of stuff, Motorhead, Venom, but you know, thrash metal just created everything that is now still today. I even think thrash metal was a huge part of like Nirvana's early sound. You know, like those guys were listening to thrash and all that stuff and new metal when that started breaking out, like in, I don't know, whatever year, 94, 95 or whatever, all new metal riffs were just the mosh parts right. of thrash songs to, you know, okay, let's break it down into a groove. Well, thrash metal's already doing that 10 years ago, so suck it, you little kids. But there you go. You know, that's why thrash metal's influence is very present in, like, look at the bands that were able to survive through the 90s when, you know, everybody was saying, oh, alternative metal, Nirvana's killing metal. It's, no, no, they're not. You know, no, like the bands that were able to survive, the Panteras, Sepultura's, you know, Biohazards or Typo Negatives, they all had some kind of heavy thrash background, you know. Machine Head came out then. They, you know, Violence, a thrashy as hell band, you know, and you know, they had a thrash, you know, just template going for themselves, and so did all the bands that survived. You know, sure as hell didn't see, you know, I don't know, like some LA cock rock band surviving the 90s, but you saw thrash metal for whatever reason, you know, it was able to keep going. Creator never stopped, Overkill never stopped. So that's, I don't know why I got on this thrash metal tangent, but I'm on it.
No,
so,
I love it.
It's just that's it there. It was the love of the music, and it still is, that keeps me going, you know. And that's why I don't worry about the money. Like, the money's always going to be there. That's why I like playing. I tell you, all more than money, I'm way more down with the fun.
Absolutely.
Of it. Like if I'm with a project and I retain myself that project there after an album or so, or after a few tours, that means I'm having fun with it. You know, I'm enjoying it and I enjoy the people, I enjoy the music, whatever. And if I come into a project and it looks like, oh, okay, Gene's in this new band. Oh no, he's not anymore. That just means it probably just stopped being fun, you know? So that's you got to look at yourself in the mirror every morning and you got to be proud of what you're doing. And if you're not having fun, then you're just playing with some band that you're not super into, then, you know, it's a job. And I don't like having a job.
Right.
I haven't had one of them since the '80s. So Jesus.
All right, and let's wrap it up on before we get into the particulars of your latest DVD. But let's wrap it up with a nice little Chuck Schuldiner story.
Well, let me see. One of my, because Chuck's always a part of most things that we do, and even yesterday I got asked by somebody by an interviewer just like, hey, what was Chuck like to work with? And I've always said that Chuck was great to work with, you know, on our musical backgrounds were so similar. You know, we both grew up on the underground heavy metal, new wave of British heavy metal, and all the Judas Priests and Iron Maidens and Black Sabbaths and all that. And all the thrash metals and whatnot. And I remember when they put out Human, I remember thinking that, wow, I'm glad I'll never play for this band, because the drums were psychotic on Human. I was like, wow, this guy's playing double bass like crazy, and he's got all these great chops, and I love playing stuff like that too, but geez, I'm glad I'll never play for this band. And sure enough, about a year later, I got the call from Chuck. But we always had a really easy working relationship. And I think that was definitely due to the template that Human was. Chuck had already played with somebody who's thinking outside the box, and Chuck was cool with that. And so when I'm trying my ideas out, keeping Human in mind, you know, hey, this band is going off in they're trying to create a new direction for themselves. And I don't think anybody was thinking about creating a new direction for metal in general, but I think death was definitely at the forefront of not only death metal, obviously, but technical death metal. And then on Symbolic, kind of forging, you know, helping forge the path for melodic metal. That's a whole lot of styles of music to have a direct influence on. And Chuck was always pretty easy to work with. And there was never a time when he was like, oh, I can't play my riffs over whatever beat you're writing. He was always like, man, I can play everything over what you're doing. I get what you're doing. So that's always been pretty cool, you know?
It seems like your personalities would have been meshed very well. It seems like he was a pretty jokester, fun-loving guy, so it seems like you guys would have got along very well.
Well, he was definitely a complicated man. You know, he had his really fun moments, but he it's not like it was a dark side or something, but you know, he would have his crabby days where, you know, he liked to watch his Oprah and he would start crabbing about whatever's on Oprah. You know, stuff like that. But,
that's awesome.
Yeah, I was always just like, okay, well, I'm cool. I'm grooving along, and you know, I don't really take all that sort of stuff too seriously. But you know, that's one of the reasons why we try with, you know, death, you know, whatever we call death. I don't even know what we're called. You know, death DTA or DTA tours or whatever the hell. I just call us death. You know, but nowadays when we take a death tour out there, we're trying to keep Chuck's memory alive. We're trying to keep his musical legacy alive. And it was so much fun to be a part of that. This is fun to do. We really enjoy going out with death because Stevie D, Bobby Coble, myself, we love jamming together. And Max, our, you know, new singers, our current, you know, Chuck or whatever, he's great too. It's just a really fun tour to go out on, and it's a tribute to Chuck. You know, we keep it all about Chuck, and we get to have a little bit of fun where we go off on a little bit of tangent, and Ironically, all the songs that we might go off into that are not death songs, just jamming, Chuck liked all those songs too. So there you go.
So the Atomic Clock Strikes Two, when does that, I don't have the release date. Do you know the release date off the top of your head?
The release date is February 2nd.
All right, February 2nd, everybody can get that. And make sure, and like I said earlier, if you're not a drummer, like, you can get this video. You know, you do a lot of talking on it. You've got a lot of special guests on it talking about, you know, singing the praises of Gene Hoagland. And then,
like my lady likes to tell me, she's like, hey, you like this story. It's about you.
Yeah, I'm like 85 episodes into the podcast, and I looked at my wife, and I was like, I'm starting to get sick of my voice, and she's like, no, you're not.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. And then you've also got the Testament Sepultura Prong Tour coming up. That's going to be awesome. And then we'll just wrap it up with what's your favorite song off the New Testament album?
The Number Game. I like all the thrashy songs on the record. I love The Number Game. I love Centuries of Suffering. I love Blackjack. Hey, we have a song about Blackjack. It's called Blackjack. And, you know, just all the super heavy stuff I'm super into. I love playing fast and heavy. I love being a part of, you know, a fast and heavy and something psychotic kind of sound song, like A Number Game, where it's like, okay, that's pretty cool. It has its kind of Fear Factory moments in it, and that's okay. But, you know, it's a jamming song, and it's pretty cool. And, you know, I like that one. You know, I like Brotherhood of the Snake. I like Pale King. I like all the super heavy numbers on it, you know.
All right, we'll go with Number Game. And Gene Hoagland, I appreciate you taking the time today.
Well, thank you very much, Josh. Thank you. It was very cool talking with you. And, hey, if we're playing anywhere near you, reach out, and we'll hook you up and come on down and catch a Testament. Catch Testament show.
You are listening to Talk To Me.
Hello, everybody. This is Max Cavalera, Soulfly, Return to Roots. And you are listening to Talk to Me. Stay metal. Oi!
And I want to say thank you to Gene Hoagland for coming on the Talk to Me podcast. Hopefully you guys checked it out and enjoyed it. And if you enjoyed it, make sure you're sharing it. Share it with a friend. The mission this week for you guys, tell two friends about the Talk to Me podcast. Say, hey, check this out. Tell me what you think. And let's see if we can't spread the word and get as many people listening as possible. Also, this weekend, if you're listening before Saturday, I will be on with the Classic Metal Show. The first 2 hours, we're doing a podcaster's roundtable. It's going to be myself, Mark Striegel of Talking Metal. We've got Chris and Aaron from Decibel Geek, Victor Ruiz of Mars Attacks Podcast. A few other guys, Chris Aiken will be on there, obviously. Neely is off. I believe he'll be at NAMM over the weekend. A couple other podcasters I've yet to meet in real life or in the podcast world, I guess. So that'll be a lot of fun. So if you guys are up and around, make sure to check that out. I'm sure I will be tweeting that out, Facebooking it out, however I get it out, and let you guys know when that's up. I'm sure there'll be a podcast form of that later. But yeah, 2 hours, podcast, war stories, all kinds of fun stuff. So make sure to check that out. So once again, thank you guys for listening each and every week and for the Talk to Me podcast. I am Joshua Toomey. You guys have a safe week, and I will talk to you soon.